Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak. Is this microphone on? So everybody can hear me? Is it working? Let's see. It's working? Okay, good. So I think Eve has just given a very nice demonstration of the bright future of radiation therapy, and I'm going to talk about the present of radiation therapy, which is maybe not quite so bright, but I hope is still at least illuminated in some sense. So I'd like to thank a lot of people. A lot of the physicists at Princess Margaret Hospital contributed to what I'm going to be presenting today. A lot of them are here in the audience, so if meeting a medical physicist is on your list of things to do before you die, you might be able to cross that off at the coffee break. We're very multidisciplinary, so we also have radiation oncologists that have contributed to this and radiation therapists who are more closely involved in the patient treatment than radiation physicists. And also, when we spoke about reaching out, we've reached out to McMaster, or they've reached out to us, or we've reached to each other, and we've developed a relationship with the optimization group at McMaster. So just to give you a little bit of an outline of what I'm going to talk about, radiation therapy, I'll give you a very brief introduction to radiation therapy and talk about some of the state-of-the-art technologies. So what I'm going to talk about is IMRT, intensity modulated radiation therapy, and IGRT, which is image-guided radiation therapy. And I'm going to talk about accuracy in radiation therapy, the magnitude of the accuracy problem, and some solutions to the accuracy problem. So radiation therapy, so I don't necessarily expect you to be able to read this. See if I can laser. So these graphs are Canadian statistics on new cases of cancer for males and for females, and deaths from cancer for males and for females. And these are broken down by the site. So if you probably can't read it, but new cases, 82,000 new cases for males, 77,000 new cases for females, 38,000 deaths for males, and 34,000 deaths for females. So this is Canada alone statistics. Americans get the same sort of cancers in the same proportion as us, so these numbers would be about 11 times higher for North America. So in North America, almost 1 million people will die of cancer this year. So this sort of gives you an idea of the scale of the problem that we're trying to deal with. You can see that some cancers are very prevalent. Prostate for males, breast for females, lung is very high for both, colorectal very high for both, and then getting into to some that are a little bit less common and some very rare cancers. You also notice that we don't do equivalently well in all cancers. So prostate is very high for males, although lung is the largest killer for males. Lung is also the largest killer for females, although breast is the most the highest incidence of cancer for females. So this is showing for different cancers 5-year relative survival ratios. So this is percentage of patients diagnosed with a particular cancer who are alive at 5 years. So the ones at the top are ones we do very well in. So testes cancer is a great cancer to get if you have to get cancer. 95% of patients who are diagnosed with it are alive 5 years later. And in fact, it's called the model of a curable cancer. And we do so well that radiation, in fact, has a relatively minor role, minor role in its current management of it. It's more of a salvage therapy. Thyroid cancer we do very well in. Prostate is the first of these that external beam radiation that I'll be talking about today has a very large role in. Breast cancer, we also have a very large role that basically every breast cancer patient gets radiation in some form. There's also the challenging ones we do very poorly in. So lung, liver, esophagus, pancreas, you can see less than 20% of patients are alive 5 years later. So less than 1 in 5 patients diagnosed with these diseases survive 5 years past their diagnosis. So this slice is showing a CT scan slice through the head of a patient with a head and neck cancer. This is a CT slice right through this part of the head. Just to orient you, this would be up where the nose and the eyes are. This is the spinal cord shown in white. This is the brain. Ears are over here. And this patient has a tumor in this area. This color wash is showing the dose delivered. Green and yellow represent a high dose around the prescription dose, and purple represents about 50% of the prescribed dose. So the goal of radiation therapy for any site is to give a high dose to the tumor, such as we're doing here, and to give a low dose to the surrounding tissue. So you can see this low dose area and the high dose area is all wrapping right around the spinal cord. So this requires an awful lot of precision. So if we give a high dose to this area, then we have a chance of curing the patient. If we give a high dose to this area, this patient could end up in a wheelchair. If we give a low dose to this area, then we may not cure the patient. If we give a low dose to this area, then the patient won't have any side effects. So every plan, there's a large balance between the appropriate dose of the tumor and what's a safe dose to actually deliver to the patient. Radiation therapy is delivered using a device called a linear accelerator. This is an example. The patient lies on a treatment couch, and this machine is able to rotate around the patient. The radiation source sits up in the head and is collimated by a collimator and something called a multi-leaf collimator. And this can rotate around and radiate the patient from different angles. The collimator is able to shape the radiation beam so it conforms to the shape of the tumor within the patient. There's a few other parts. This is an imaging device which is able to collect the beam that comes out of the head of the machine and conform an image of the X-ray radiation. This is a kilovoltage X-ray source that can produce an imaging beam for imaging the patient on the couch and the detector that's opposite that. Up in the head of the machine, so if you're lying on the couch and looking up, the radiation source would be up here. And this is the collimation of a modern radiation therapy machine. And this is called a multi-leaf collimator. And what it basically consists of is a bunch of metal fingers that can each independently be driven in and out of the beam. And these allow us to create essentially arbitrary shapes for the radiation beam. So in this, you can see there's a relatively triangle-shaped aperture and rectangular-shaped aperture. Basically replaces lead shielding blocks that were used prior to this invention to create a beam shape that's customized for a particular patient. So to move on to state-of-the-art technologies, the multi-leaf collimator really enables IMRT. So IMRT is basically radiation therapy where we change the fluence, the X-ray fluence, or the intensity of the beam in different portions of the beam. So the left side of the beam may have a higher intensity than the right side. And this is done by moving the leaves of the multi-leaf collimator to selectively block portions of the beam while we're radiating the patient. So you may not be able to see it well. This is showing a prostate cancer patient with beams coming from multiple different angles, and there's plots showing the fluence, which are non-uniform in this case. So in this case, the right side of this, the posterior part of this beam is giving a higher dose than the anterior part of this beam. So you can imagine if you have to create this by moving these mechanical collimators around, it's very difficult to do manually, so you need some sort of improved solution. So very quickly people realize that it's an optimization problem, so that we need a way to optimize the assignment of non-uniform intensities to tiny subdivisions of the beam. In radiation therapy, one thing I want to point out is that IMRT is not a it's a new technology, but it's a mature technology. It's one that's widely implemented. So this is a graph showing number of IMRT patients treated in Canada starting in the year 2000 and increasing. And each of the different colors indicates a different institution in Canada. So Princess Margaret Hospital is the yellow bar. So you can see that we're doing about half of the IMRT treatments in Canada, about 1,500 patients a year, which represents probably somewhere about a quarter or a third of our caseload. But you can see that this is increasing very quickly. So this is a technology that's been very rapidly adopted and is no longer something that's experimental or difficult to do necessarily. It's something we do routinely every day. So I thought I'd walk you through the exciting research application that you just saw of IMRT, the mundane clinical application of IMRT with a commercial planning system. Which will hopefully not be too mundane. So this is a prostate cancer patient. So this is a CT slice right through the pelvis of a prostate cancer patient. Showing an axial slice, a sagittal slice, sliced in the middle of the patient, and a coronal slice this way. Contoured are the prostate in red, the bladder is shown in green, and the rectum in brown. And the heads of the femurs have been highlighted in purple. So in addition, you can see that there's a blue margin. This margin around the clinical target volume, the prostate, is the planning target volume. So this is a margin that's intended to account for the fact that this prostate might move around. There might be some uncertainty getting them in the right place on the treatment couch. So we basically add a safety margin and irradiate a slightly larger volume than what we really want to hit clinically. So these would be done, the prostate would be defined by the physician. The physician would also define the rectum and the bladder. And then this would be handed off to a dosimetrist, someone who does treatment planning. This is showing a window out of the treatment planning window in our commercial treatment planning system. and shows you basically some of the knobs and widgets you have to work with in a commercial system. So you can choose how many iterations you're going to optimize over. You can choose a stopping tolerance. You can choose the maximum number of segments. So this is basically how many different intensity levels you're going to use in your optimization, how many different field shapes are going to be used. You have some machine sort of parameters in terms of field size and how long the beam will be on for. And you have your choice of optimization type. So for each beam, which here are defined by the angle at which they enter the patient in, there's 7 beams. And the optimization type here is DMPO, which is a commercial name for a direct machine parameter optimization, which basically means, unlike old-style MRT, where you would come up with an idealized fluence and then fit this to what the machine could actually deliver with its multi-leaf collimator, it's actually going to optimize by moving the leaves around during the optimization process. So this doesn't sound like a big deal, but it means you're always optimizing on a deliverable plan instead of an idealized fluence that at the end you might not actually be able to deliver. So clinically, that was a big plus for us in terms of avoiding a lot of problems in the delivery of these plans. So in the planning window, I might, if I was being fairly naive, add a couple objectives. And I might just add a couple minimum dose objectives for my target volumes and say, give me this minimum dose of my target volumes and go ahead. Click Start Optimization. Let it run, and I might get something that looks like this. So basically, red is a high dose. Yellow is 95% of the prescription dose that I would like to cover my target volume with. Red is 105 or greater percent of the prescription dose, which is too hot for this particular plan. Blue represents 95%, showing an axial, a sagittal, and a coronal slice. So in this case, you can see that this plan is giving a high dose, certainly with only 2 objectives, has produced something conformal, but there's a very high dose through here. And this is a bit of a problem, particularly in the context of the prostate, because the entire prostate gland is not tumor cells. The prostate is a gland within the patient, and in the male prostate, the male urethra, well, the only males have a prostate, but the male urethra runs right through the middle of the prostate, and this is a critical organ. So you don't actually want to give too high of a dose to the urethra, otherwise you end up introducing side effects. So I might see this, and I might look at my dose volume histograms. So dose volume histograms are basically cumulative histograms of how much of a volume of the organ is getting how much dose. So the ideal dose volume histogram for a tumor would come straight across and come pretty much straight down at your prescription dose. The ideal for a healthy organ would basically come down as a straight line. So you want to push tumors up and to the right. You want to push healthy tissues down and to the left. So my prostate and my planning target volume in red and blue, you can see are pretty sharp, although they're getting a pretty high dose, so I'm prescribing 78 gray, which they cover, but they get up to 90 gray being the unit of dose, which happens to be a little too hot for this application. The bladder in green, I can look across, I can see 10% of the bladder is getting more than my prescription dose, so that's a little bit too much. And the rectum is in brown. It's not as bad, but it could use a little bit of work. And the 2 femurs are shown in purple. So clinically, what I would do is I'd go back and give this another shot. So I'd put on my target volume some objectives, control the dose. So basically say, I want at least 95% of the prescription dose in my planning target volume, but don't go over 105% of the prescription dose. And I also put an objective on the bladder to say, don't put a maximum dose on that's greater than the prescription dose. So I let that run, and it run for a half hour, 45 minutes, and I come back, and it has something that would look like this. So this is much better. You can see the orange is 100% of the prescription dose. The red is entirely gone, so nothing is getting more than 105% of the prescription dose. And you can see that it's much more conformal around the area of the bladder. But I can look at this, I can see it's still bleeding out a little bit on the posterior side where the rectum is, and can maybe use a little bit of shaping up. I might look at the dose volume histograms again. So you can see these are nice. They come over and come down very sharply. You can see the high dose part of the bladder in the green has been pushed down and to the left, so it's much cooler. Now maybe I might look at the rectum and say, now I can start working on this problem. So I'd go and add a few other things. So I'd add one on the rectum, and while I'm at it, add a couple on the femurs. And I'll point out here I'm mixing a lot of different sort of objectives. So I have some minimum dose objectives on the target volumes. I have a maximum dose on the bladder. I have one that's a maximum dose to a volume. And I have a EUD, an equivalent uniform dose, which is sort of a generalized mean. So I'm mixing a lot of different sort of optimization parameters. And when I run this, you can see that it has tightened up a little bit on the rectum, made it a little bit better. This at this point is a clinically acceptable plan. You can see sharp target volume DVHs. So essentially the entire target volume gets very close to 100% of the prescription dose without any hot spots. The rectum and bladder are controlled, and so are the femurs. So that's a sort of a window into clinical planning. And then if I went and looked at the field shapes that I made, so for one of the particular beams, in this case it's decided it's going to use 10 different field shapes to modulate the intensity of this beam. So here we are, this is what we call a beam's eye view. So basically looking at the source in the treatment machine, looking down at the patient. And in this case, the prostate's in red, the planning target volume, the safety margin around it in blue, bladder in green, and the rectum is here, so in brown. So you can see there's a couple segments that look basically like the prostate, and then you can see a few moving around with a couple smaller ones sharpening up the dose at the edges. So that's IMRT in a nutshell. A newer, more novel thing than IMRT is IGRT, image-guided radiation therapy. And Princess Margaret Hospital has a relatively long history of doing image-guided radiation therapy. One of our most mature programs is also our prostate program, so in which we've used prostate fiducial markers. So a fiducial marker is basically something that's easy to image to be able to tell where a target volume lies. In a prostate patient, it's medically considered not too inconvenient to put an ultrasound probe into the rectum and insert three little metal markers into the prostate. This is showing you the markers. These are gold markers relative to the size of a dime. So they're very small, but for X-ray imaging, they're very useful in that they're very dense and they're a high atomic number, so they're very easy to image. An X-ray of a prostate patient, a projection X-ray radiograph from top or interior to posterior. So you can see the heads of the femurs, you can see the pelvic bone, the spine. We know the prostate is in here somewhere. We certainly can't see the prostate because the soft tissue of the prostate has similar X-ray attenuation properties to all the other soft tissue around it. So it doesn't really show up on an X-ray radiograph on a projection image. But you can see very easily the three gold markers that we've placed within the prostate. So if we produce this sort of image at the time of treatment, we can assess prior to turning on the beam, do we have the patient's prostate in the right place before we turn the beam on? So as the technology's evolved, it's gone from projection imaging to tomographic imaging. So this is an example of the linear accelerator. So I pointed out before, it has a megavoltage source and a detector opposite that, and it has a kilovoltage source and a detector opposite that. So basically, a rotating kilovoltage source with a detector is an awful lot like a modern computed tomography CT scanner. So we can actually now produce a computed tomography X-ray image of the patient in the position before we turn the beam on. And the advantage of this is that you get a lot more information. So instead of being able to pick up some bone and high contrast markers, you can get a three-dimensional image like this. The image is fully three-dimensional. Certainly bone is very easy to pick out. You can see the bladder, the prostate, you can see the rectum, and you can even make out muscle and fat. So the quality of the imaging is much improved with modern technology, and this allows us to do some things in terms of image guidance that haven't been possible before. I should point out also it only requires one rotation to actually acquire this image. It doesn't have to rotate around and around and around the patient. So what kind of precision is possible? So if you put gold markers into the prostate of a patient and then acquire these cone beam tomographic images, and then look at the precision that we can align them with. So small sigma is the random uncertainty in localizing the prostate. Big sigma is the systematic uncertainty in localizing prostate. And these numbers are standard deviations in millimeters. So for using markers, we can get the prostate in the right place with a standard deviation of about 1 millimeter, which is pretty good for radiation therapy. If you don't actually put markers in and try to match based on the soft tissue, This is a little more difficult because even on a cone beam CT, as good as it is, it's not as good as a diagnostic CT scanner, and there's a little bit more interpretation about where the prostate is. So you're looking at standard deviations of more on the order of 2 to 2.5 millimeters. So we haven't quite adopted this yet as our clinical standard because we'd like to be able to see this become a little bit tighter in terms of precision. However, this, for some sites other than prostate, this would actually be a very substantial improvement. And just to show some of the examples of the kind of images, currently what we do for our prostate patients is we do a cone beam image that looks something like this, with a coronal, a sagittal, and an axial slice. This is through basically a mock-up, a phantom pelvis that's full of water with a rubber prostate inside that mimics the X-ray intensity, and the three gold seeds, the gold traditional markers, put into the prostate. So what we're currently doing now, we give a very small dose, about much less than 1% of the fractional prescription dose, and this allows us to three-dimensionally image the markers and to guide the patients. If we go up by a factor of 6 in the dose we use for the imaging, it doesn't project particularly well, but you can actually drive a little bit more contrast out and actually get a better image of the soft tissue. But this is not quite our routine yet, but has a lot of promise for many sites. So on to accuracy. So why is all this imaging important, and why are uncertainties in accuracy a problem in radiation therapy? So a very nice demonstration has come out of MD Anderson showing prostate cancer patients where they went back and retrospectively analyzed patients and made the assumption that in prostate cancer, if you're lying on your back, your prostate basically sits right on top of your rectum. For these patients, they basically went back and looked at how big the rectum was. So you can imagine if your rectum is filled either with gas or with stool, that it's going to push your prostate up, and then if it empties, then it's going to push the prostate down. So basically, they looked at the cross-sectional area of people's rectum at the time of planning, with the thought that if you have a very large rectum at the time of planning, your prostate is going to be pushed up, and it's going to be higher than it is over the course of treatment. So your prostate is going to be systematically lower during the course of treatment, and you're going to miss the prostate some of the time. And basically, they looked at a cross-sectional area of the rectum of 11 square centimeters, and basically, this is showing biochemical free control. So basically, failure as detected by a PSA test in time after radiation therapy. And it turns out that if you had a small rectum, so your rectum was not distended at the time of treatment, you had about a 90% probability of being disease-free 6 to 10 years after treatment. If your rectum was full at the time of treatment and then presumably systematically your prostate was missed over the course of treatment, you had less than a 60% chance of being free of disease. This is very interesting. So this is the first sort of clinical evidence that errors in geometric precision directly translate into clinical outcomes. And it's really very dramatic that this goes, in fact, across different stages of prostate cancer. So if you look at all the staging workup we do to see is this patient a high-risk prostate cancer, low-risk prostate cancer, that is as important as how big the patient's rectum was at the time of treatment. So it's important to note this is before the era of image-guided radiation therapy. So we'd like to think in our current process with putting gold seeds into the patient, imaging them, making sure the patient's in the right place, turning on the beam, this isn't a problem. But this retrospective analysis of an older process certainly indicates that geometric precision is a very important element of radiation therapy. So another example, you heard about a treatment of liver cancer before. This is a similar treatment. This is a SBRT, which stands for stereotactic body radiation therapy, which is basically a type of radiotherapy where we try to be very precise, treat for a relatively small number of fractions to give a very high dose per fraction. And these patients get basically the full arsenal of radiation therapy technology thrown at them. They're imaged every day before treatment to make sure they're in the right place. And they also have some technology to try to keep a reproducible breath hold to make sure that they're not moving their tumor around by breathing motion. So this shows the plan for a patient on an axial sagittal and coronal, showing the gross tumor volume is getting a minimum dose of 49 gray as planned. the planning target volume has a minimum dose of 29 gray. So where we've gone is done and looked at the images where the patient was at the time we turned on the beam and basically reconstructed this. So this is basically showing the position of dose reconstructed for each of this patient's six treatments. So you see there's a little bit of wobble. So even with lots of technology thrown at it, imaging right before, we don't have zero uncertainty in localizing the tumor. There's a little bit, but you can see that the wobble is right around the position of the tumor. We're generally hitting it very well most of the time. And if you compare what we planned to what we delivered, the reconstruction is pretty much exact. We planned a gross tumor volume minimum dose of 49 gray, we ended up delivering 50 gray. So in general, we'd call that an excellent execution of the treatment. So you might say that liver cancers are easy to treat, maybe you don't need all this technology. So what we did is we went back and because we had before imaging and after imaging, we went back and reassessed what did this treatment look like if we didn't use image guidance. So if we hadn't changed the patient's position based on all this imaging. And as it turns out, this patient had a 2-centimeter systematic shift of the high dose volume over the course of treatment. So 2 centimeters doesn't sound like a lot maybe, but it's for radiation therapy is huge. So you can see this is, again, each of the six fractions where the dose would have been placed if we hadn't moved the patient prior to turning on the beam. So you can see that it's not even centered on the gross tumor. It's centered up above the gross tumor, up in the lung. You can see there's entire treatments where the entire middle of the gross tumor is being missed. So obviously, this would have been a very poor treatment execution. So if you looked at the planned versus delivered, you can see we would have been delivering dose on average up here instead of down where the tumor is, so up by the dome of the liver and in the lung, and we would have a gross tumor volume minimum dose of 16 gray instead of the prescribed 49 gray. So this treatment would have been subtherapeutic and potentially somewhat harmful. So given that geometric uncertainties are a problem in radiation therapy, how can we go about trying to solve them? So obviously one thing is to reduce them. So we can try to reduce them through using better imaging at the planning stage, and we can try to use them by using better imaging, image-guided radiation therapy for treatment localization of the treatment stage. And the other thing we can do is we can try to anticipate them. So if we know there's uncertainties and we have some idea what the magnitude is, we can design safety margins to try to account for them. We can look at robust optimization approaches, or we can try to adapt our treatment to account for them. So one is imaging for planning. So on the CT scans I was showing, you probably noticed that it's pretty hard to see exactly where the prostate starts and stops. It's kind of a gray blob in the middle of a lot of other gray stuff. This is showing 5 different patients who had very good quality MRI scans as part of their planning. And the prostate stands out very nicely on MRI compared to on CT. So incorporating MRI into the planning process maybe reduces a lot of the uncertainty in the initial definition of where the prostate is. And these images are in fact so good that you can actually pick out structure within the prostate. So here you can pick out the peripheral part of the prostate compared to the rest of the prostate, and you can even pick out gross tumor disease within the prostate. So we generally treat the prostate as though the whole thing is one big tumor, but that's not actually true. The prostate is a healthy gland, and there's a burden of disease somewhere within it. So you can just define it here, you can see it here. This sort of imaging, one, makes it much easier to decide where the prostate is, to define it with accuracy, and two, it opens the doors for new sorts of treatment options where maybe we don't need to treat the entire prostate to the doses we are today. Maybe we can focus more on the specific burden of disease within the prostate. Another new technology is 4D CT. So I showed a lot of static CT scans. If your patient's breathing and if you have a way of measuring this breathing and correlating it as you actually acquire the CT scan, you can reconstruct a 4-dimensional CT scan where you take the breathing and break it into different phases. So you might be able to look at this lung tumor and be able to image it at different time points, quantify its motion, and account for that motion as you're planning your treatment. And finally, you can use image-guided radiation therapy. So you can take your patient, image them prior to treatment, and then turn the beam on and see what happens. So this is a simulation of the treatment of a nasal pharyngeal patient. So this is a patient, these are sagittal images through the head of a patient. So the nose, the brain, the chin, the spinal cord, the brainstem is here and the tumor is here. These are reconstructions of a stochastic simulation treating the patient without performing the correction and with having performed the image-guided correction. So these numbers refer to the maximum dose delivered to the brainstem. So I've taken four random samples out of the simulation where with no corrections, so just putting the patient on the treatment couch and turning on the beam, you give 48 gray, 57 gray, 47 gray, 59 gray to the brainstem. So 48 gray, 47 gray are tolerable. 57 gray, 59 gray, our oncologists start getting a little twitchy and a little concerned about the safety of the brainstem. Performing image-guided corrections, 49 gray, 49 gray, 49 gray, 47 gray. So these are four samples from each, but it goes to show that you avoid the very bad stochastic problems with image guidance. You have a lot more precision. You have a lot more accuracy in terms of delivering what you actually planned for your patient. So if you can't reduce your uncertainties, how do you account for them? So one thing to do is to add a margin. So give yourself the safety margin, irradiate a larger volume within the patient. So this patient, we have a gross tumor volume. We have a clinical target volume that we want to give the prescription dose to. And then we define a planning target volume. So we add this safety margin to define this purple volume so that when this patient is breathing and this tumor is moving around, hopefully if our planning target volume is defined correctly, the clinical target volume will actually receive the prescribed dose. So the planning target volume, as crude as it sounds, is in fact the de facto standard for accounting for geometric uncertainties in radiation therapy. The concept is about 15 years old, and it's very robust and very widely used. So what else can you do? You can do robust optimization. So this is some work from Millie Chu, and you heard a lot about robust optimization in the previous talk, where basically they've taken a prostate plan with the dashed lines and planned using a robust optimization with the solid lines. And you can see target coverage is equivalently good, but if you look at the bladder in green or the rectum in blue, you can see the solid line is pushed down into the left of the dashed line, indicating you have less volume, or you have more volume getting less dose, and you're avoiding more bladder, more rectum, more healthy tissue using a robust approach as opposed to a straightforward planning approach. Something else you can do is you can adapt. So we're acquiring a lot more three-dimensional imaging data than we have before. So this is a sagittal image through a prostate patient. You'll take my word for it, the prostate is here. This is one of the gold seeds you can see. This is the bladder, and this is the patient's rectum here. So that's what the patient looked like when we took the scan to start the planning. When the patient came in for the first treatment day, which we refer to as treatment fractions, the prostate's over here, the bladder's over here. Rectum, this black is all gas within the rectum. So you can see this patient's rectum and sigmoid colon, they're in a different position, they're filled differently at the time of treatment than they are planning. So you can say, well, maybe that's not what they look like. You know, maybe they just had some gas at the beginning of treatment, maybe that changed. So you can take another comb beam scan at the end of treatment. So comb beam at the end of treatment, you can see that this gas is still here. You can actually see even worse than just being there. It's actually moved a little bit, which implies the prostate probably moved a little bit from the time we turned the first beam on to the time the last beam went off. So you can say, well, maybe that was just a bad day. Day two, there's gas also in the rectum. Day three, again, a different pattern of filling, but still not empty. And day four, again, there's filling that's all not consistent with the way this patient was when we planned the patient. So I think we have all this information. Maybe we can adapt the treatment. Maybe we can replan. Ideally, we'd love to be able to replan every fraction, say, image the patient, redefine the target volume, and replan. The technology isn't there to do that, but that would be a wonderful thing. But maybe you can take the information from the first few fractions and say, this first scan that we had of the patient is not a good representation of this patient's treatment. Maybe we need to adapt our treatment, change our treatment plan partway into the treatment to plan something that really does represent the way their anatomy presents on every single day. So to wrap up, image-guided radiation therapy and intensity modulated radiation therapy, they're powerful new tools we have for radiation therapy treatment. Hopefully I've convinced you that large uncertainties in treatment delivery can result in poor outcomes in radiation therapy, and tools such as quantitative margin design, robust optimization, and adaptive treatment processes have a lot of promise to reduce the impact of uncertainties in radiation therapy. Thank you.